good morning, good day, and good evening. I don't know how this episode's happening, but today we have the Primogen. Welcome to the show. How you doing?
I am doing very, very well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you for doing this. I have this problem, right, where I have imposter syndrome. So when there is someone who is, you know, noticeably more well-known than I am, I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to message them because, they're probably just not going to be interested, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And then you sent me that message last year, like, hey, I saw the, I think it was the Miku Chan video, and you were like, oh, I'm going to react to this. And then I don't think you did because your audio broke during that part of your stream. But that gave me the excuse to send the message. So here you are. How you doing?
Yeah, precisely. I remember you. I mean, you have a lot of videos on Vim, but one of them was on Vim, and I was just like, ooh, I want to watch this one because it looks really good.
It probably was.
And then I was going to do it, and then my audio broke, and then I think my computer froze, and then I think I just turned off the stream. I was like, that's it. I quit.
Well,
it happens.
Yeah, it does happen, sadly. I mostly have things that just work at this point, but sometimes like a config file just won't be loaded, or some like update changes something. You're like, what is going on? What is this?
Yeah, well, I run, so the problem is I kind of have a multi-computer setup, and so I run my Linux box through a capture card onto a Windows PC. So I do all my streaming via Windows.
Right.
Just because, I mean, I had a Go XLR, and at that point, that thing didn't even have a Linux driver when I first got it, like, even available. So I was just like, Windows it is, you know, like, and so I was just using that. Plus, I had a Stream Deck, and I had to, like, write, the board's way too small. I can't actually even get it on screen. That thing.
Yeah.
That one, I'd have to write my own back then for Linux. Yeah. So I was just like, this is stupid. I'm just not going to do that.
Yeah.
I'm just going to have all my tech work. And surprisingly, it doesn't work that often.
Yeah, I've made the explicit purchase choices of things that I know work on Linux. I've considered trying out some stuff. Like, I know nowadays you have Boatswain. Boatswain is like a tool to configure the Stream Deck. I don't know how well it works, but considering you don't have all of the nice integrations you have on Windows as well, where you can just easily say, oh, I want to play a thing in OBS. You've got to deal with like WebSocket stuff, and you can do it. It's just a lot of extra overhead that I don't want to deal with, really.
Exactly. Like, the thing is that I like programming. I like building stuff. What I don't like is configuring, right? Like, just spending time being like, okay, why doesn't this thing work? Well, there's no manual. I'm just going to have to, like, play with it and print stuff out until I figure out how it works, and then I will eventually get there. It's just like, it doesn't, that's not, for me, that's not what I get excited about. I get excited about building something. I have this dumb idea in my head, and I'm like, I will make this thing work, right? Streaming is not a dumb idea in my head that I want to make work.
Yeah.
I'm already doing it. It already works. I don't need anything else. Like, so I iterate as low or as best as I can, depending on what I want out of it.
Well, I guess we can sort of get into that. Do you want to start talking about streaming or how you got into, like, programming first? We can go either direction.
You get to choose. A host choice.
Okay, you know what? We'll get into your like, tech background first and then go from there. So I assume that you've had an interest in tech for a long time. I know you've been programming for a really long time as well, but, like, when did all of that start for you? And what did you start on?
Yeah. So I don't know the name of the language. I'm not even sure if it had a name of a language. There was a video game in the 90s called Grail or Grawl. It was like G-R-A-A-L. And it was like a Zelda clone that you could also open up a level editor. And the level editor, you could double click on PCs, on treasure chests, on pretty much any interactable item. Mm-hmm. And it actually came with a small scripting language. And so when I was there, I just like, oh, that's kind of cool. And I found one that did like a spiral fire, like,
okay.
And so I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. And I opened it up and there was just a bunch of math and a while loop and X's and all that. And I've never seen code before. And I was just like, that's kind of neat. So I started tweaking with it and I started kind of figuring things out. Then eventually I could figure out how to shoot fire in a straight line. Cause I was like, okay, yeah, you just add stuff to X X means horizontal, Y means up and down. Like, I didn't realize that you could swap the variable names or anything. And eventually, I kept just figuring things out. And I was like, oh, this is really fun. I knew about while loops and basic stuff. You know, it's like some NPC script. It looks like C. It's C-ish. Mm. And so it was pretty easy for me to just kind of get running and doing that. And then in high school, I took a programming class, QBasic. It was okay. I made the mistake of just making a dumb game. I made Blackjack, very boring game to make, as it is. Should have done something different. And then I went to college and did a lot of Java, and it really kind of hit home for me more in my second class. After my first class, I thought, maybe I don't want to be a programmer. You know, like, maybe making those games and all that was fun, but this isn't that fun. Like, this
was that
is
a
kinda...
Java thought or a programming thought?
Programming thought, because, right, you know, like, school intro to programming is like, here's the size of an int, here's the this, here's the that. Like, it's not fun, to put it mildly, right? It's very academic. And looking back, very happy that I had it that way, right? A lot of people don't get that, and they don't get a 4-year slow introduction into programming where you slowly get more and more complex. They just get thrown into a deep end, and like, here's how you render a div, right? Like, I didn't start there. Like, that's crazy.
A lot of people starting on, like, boot camps, for example, where they're like, oh, I just build a web application. It's just like, you don't have the core fundamental understanding of how these things actually work, like what memory management is, what a pointer is. It's something you then have to learn after the fact.
Precisely. And so it's one of those things that it's just, I'm very happy it happened. But after my first class, I was pretty disheartened. And then my second class, week one, I was like, it's going to be just more stuff I don't want to do. And then week two hit, and it was like, all right, time to start data structures. And it's like, let's go over a linked list.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, public class node, curly brace. I'm like, okay, curly brace. And it's like, next node.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw it, I was like, what? It references. And all of a sudden, it's just like, I see memory, right? Like, I was just like, oh my God, this is the coolest thing ever. And then it was cool after that. And then after that, it was just like, that was the moment that was true. Like, I remember just being floored at how cool the fact that you could reference yourself in a class and you could just keep on going. Yep. And I could see it. And that was like my first time ever seeing something, you know, in your mind's eye like that. And so I was just like, this is absolutely the coolest. And I think that's probably the moment where, like, I truly fell in love with programming, if that makes sense.
No, I have a very similar experience. I wrote, there was a game library called Greenfoot, which is like an introductory education thing that I learned back in high school. Then when I got into university, I did some introductory Python stuff. Probably wrote Blackjack and Rock, Paper, Scissors and maybe like Game of Life, things like basic things. Then I also had my data structures course, which was also in Java. And I know exactly the feeling you're talking about. And then I did, I think it was an assignment on trees or something, and A star out, like basic like searching algorithms. Like, wait, that? And then like you can start piecing it together in real world problems. Like you see, map that is just a really complex graph, and you're using these same sort of concepts. So even though you're doing this simple thing, you can see how it like pieces into these bigger problems.
Yeah, exactly. It's exciting. It just gets so dang exciting. And then once you start seeing that, it just feels so cool.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely. The only problem is just, I feel like a lot of educators who just don't get into the content, it's just another year of teaching the same content. It's another group of students, especially when they don't do new assignments each time. I think the best classes I had is the ones where the professors actually made new content every time. Like, it was the same sort of structure, but it was like, okay, I had like a web dev class, for example. One year they did like a weather application. Another year it was some other thing. And it was like the same core tooling and the same sort of core concepts, but the topic around it was different. I think that helps keep them interested, along with it getting the students interested as well.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. You'll see a much more excited professor if he's actually, you know, if he's engaged, then you can see it a lot more. Like, I had a professor, Hunter Lloyd, in Montana State University, very much so like this, just was totally into robots and all that. And I think he appeared on Jay Leno with his alarm clock that you'd throw, and if it hit the wall, it would snooze for 10 minutes and then ring, so then you'd have to go get it. And so it was like a very, very clever idea, right? Mm. And so very, very funny. And is just, you know, he was so engaged, it made me so engaged.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
So I had a class that I know that you don't like the fact that they exist. I had an entire semester class on learning Git.
Oh, hold on. When you say learning Git, literally just like executing commands, or like this is source control. This is the difference between perforce and how it does object storage versus Git, or just like literally like this week it's Git add period.
This was a... maybe 3 days of content stretched over a semester. So my final assignment for that class, you had to commit some code, you had to write some like merge requests, and that's pretty much it. It was like maybe 30 minutes of work, and that was 40% of the grade for that class. It was a joke.
That actually hurts. It does truly hurt me that can even exist.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me sad because it shouldn't exist. Like, it just shouldn't be a thing. It's not real.
Yeah.
Because, again, that's 30 minutes outside of class. Like, what I want to see professors do, be like, by the way, we're on GitHub. Submit your stuff via GitHub.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. It's just like, okay, I will go learn how to Git add and Git commit. And if you had everyone kind of push some sort of Git, yeah, you know, you can have your university host a Git server. It's not like that's that crazy, right? You know, just have that. People will naturally at least figure out the most important commands. Git add period, git commit dash m, git push, git pull. Like that's like 95% of real world Git. There's like the 5% where you're actually like, I gotta add this hunk, I'm gonna ignore this hunk. Like no one's
bisecting.
Doing that, you know?
Bisecting's fun.
Yeah. Bisecting's fun, but you're already in a bad place when you're bisecting. Life already sucks when you're there.
No, but I know what you mean.
So I also find that bisecting is not always that useful, because whenever on the applications I've had to bisect on, it's like a 20-30 minute process per one. So it's like, I'm going to go search the logs and try to find the most likely spots, I think. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm going to just try to be more clever, because it's like, I have 500 commits. That's like 6 days. So let's just be super clever here and try to jump through it.
Mm-hmm. No, but I know what you mean about, we're saying with like learning Git. I hadn't even thought of doing it like that, because when I got my assignments, they were all through some like online learning platform. You just download a zip and that downloads all of it. But if you just force the student, like even if it's not uploading the content, at least forcing them to pull the content down from like a Git server, like even just that is just a basic introduction. And then from there, you've already got the Git repo anyway. So you might as well start messing around with it. And, you know, it.
Yeah, because if you have to push it back up as well, then at that point you minimally have to learn add and commit.
Yeah,
like minimally you're just gonna sheer accident learn those two things.
Like use that as the way you submit the assignment.
Yeah, and so it's like at least minimally you will make people learn a thing. Like as far as a class goes, something that I think would be a way cooler class is, here's how source control works. Let's go over the algorithms. Mm-hmm. Why is perforce good for large assets? Why does Git suck for large assets? What, you know, how does Git handle large assets using, I forget, there's like some sort of Git binary addition you can use to make large assets good. And so it's like, let's learn about how to make one. So when you have a problem, you're like, I know everything. You know, it's just dumb to have a class that shows you some basic commands.
Yeah, in the same way, So my university is often described as, so we have a thing in Australia called TAFE, which is basically just like boot camps for various things. Like it's a barber boot camp, a programming, like it's all these, like it's a technical school. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay.
And a lot of people describe my university as basically like a super version of that. It's just a longer version. So a lot of my classes were just, hey, here's how to learn, like here's learning Java, here's learning Python, here's learning C++, but I think the courses that stuck with me the most, and I wish there were more of them, were those ones where it was, like my AI course, for example, where it wasn't focused on a language, it was focused on the concepts of, okay, how do these neural network systems work? Like, what are the algorithms? What is all the maths behind it? As opposed to like, oh, this week we're going over chapter one of the C programming language. Now it's chapter two. Like, I can do that outside of class when I need to, or I can learn that content as like I need to learn it. But how do, if you want to go learn a language?
Say that again.
I was going to say, if you want to go learn a language, like, what is the process you normally take now?
If I'm learning a language, typically I go straight to just trying to build something. Like, I have enough of the core concepts down that I can, you know, any C-based language, I can effectively run with it. And now any functional language, I at least have some concept of kind of what they're about. You know, I did a little bit of OCaml, you know, tried to build a little bit of some web stuff with OCaml, just like barely trying to figure it out. But nonetheless, and did some advent of code. But typically I just try to solve stuff, build real stuff, because like, if you were telling me, hey, you need to go learn C#, right? Like, I'm pretty sure I could learn C# really quick, right? I could just get up there. Okay, how do I start a server? Okay, this is how I start a server. Let's try to come up with a good project. Okay, here's a good project. Let's actually build something. Let's build a good CLI tool to parse out all these logs and figure something out with it. Right? That's, to me, that's, at this point, that's the best way. And then I like to go, after I kind of get the basics down and kind of understand it, then typically I'll go buy a book on it. And like read through what they did. So that way I already have this like really practical foundational knowledge. And I'm like, oh, I could see why I was totally doing that wrong. This is way cooler. Okay, this is way cooler. Because often if I read first, I just miss out like on a lot of that. Like, I don't have that like heart change. Like, oh, I understand why they do it this way. Because you know, I just don't have that experience. So it just means nothing to me.
I imagine that is especially true if like the first time you started doing functional, where it's a whole different paradigm of program where you can like see what it's being written there, but the concepts are not going to stick because it's just such a different way to write the code. I myself have never actually done functional programming. I know there are a lot of people that are very dedicated on functional and this is the greatest way to write code. OOP is the worst thing ever created. What is the appeal of functional? Like, obviously you said you've not like the most experienced at
it,
but
touched it.
Yeah. From what you've seen, what is the appeal?
Well, I would say there's some constructs that are super nice in functional. A lot of pattern matching. Like Elixir, a really cool thing Elixir has is that you can define a function many times, kind of like function overloading, except for instead of like arguments you're taking in, it's the shape of the argument you're taking in. So I'm going to define, say, foo, and it takes in the empty array, and I'll do the case with empty array. Then I'll redo foo, but it takes in an array with one element. And I'll do the thing with one element. And then I'll do foo with the general array case and then program that one. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like it strips the if statements out and brings it up into a language level construct. And to me, that's super, super cool because you're pattern matching on the function and you're like defining how this function will be called at a language level, like how your array will interact with it. And so that's like super duper cool to me because that's a lot of things that I want, which is I hate functions with a bunch of if statements, but if I could actually just put the shape inside the function, then it's like I can define that case and it's like so easy to understand this case. The empty case looks like this three lines of code. It's so clean. It's so obvious. It's not somewhere within wherever I decided to handle the zero line case, right? And so for me, there's like a lot of cool concepts. Obviously, partial application, being able to you have a function that takes in three parameters, A, B, C, and I go foo and I pass in five. Out comes a function. This is like an OCaml. And that function has five curried in it. So when I call it with B and C, five will already be auto-applied to that new function that I had pop out of it because it's been partially applied. The function hasn't been fully, like, I don't know all the right terms. I'm not a functional bro.
No,
like
I don't know the terms either. Use whatever term makes sense.
I don't have a lot of experience yet, but I think that's like super duper neat because then you can define these functions. It's like in JavaScript, if you were to do this, you would define a function, say like you wanted to do a timer. And so you wanted to create an ability that is a function that returns a function that is a timer. So then I can pass in 5 minutes into the first function and then it returns a function for me that will be the 5 minute timer every single time. Right. So that's kind of like what you could do in OCaml, except for you would just simply have one function and the first parameter is the time. And then I call it with just the time and out comes a function that's now locked into that and will always have that time come in as the first parameter. So it's like, oh, that's super cool. Like that's a, That's a much, like, that's just, I can't describe that in JavaScript. I have to write a function that returns a function. You just write a function and it just is automatically a part of the language. It's just different. And OCaml also, like, OCaml is super cool in a sense that if you wanted to add two numbers together, you'd use a plus sign. If you want to add two strings together, you'd use a caret. If you want to add two floating points, you'd use a plus dot, which means that by the syntax of what you're doing, it can infer every single type, and it actually is a fully typed language. It is type safe. It actually is fully inferred. You can specify your type, but you virtually never need to, because it just knows by how you're using it exactly what's going on. And so you will create a function that's like function AB, A plus B, A will go, this is an int function. That's what you want. Int returns an int, because I can tell because of the syntax used here. And so it's like, wow, that's pretty cool. So when you try to call it with a float, it's like, you can't do that. You can't provide a float here. This is not a float function.
Right. That sounds really cool. I'm not, like, you have these language concepts where it's like, this is a neat idea. I'm not sure, like, where I would realistically apply them, but I kind of want to go learn it now. Like,
yeah, there's a lot of recursions. You got to be like really into recursion as well.
I have a whiteboard.
They obviously have tail
here.
Call optimization. Yeah, they like. I mean, if you know recursion, it's not hard to at least see it. But to always reach for recursion as opposed to like thinking in loops is really hard.
Right.
And so I kept finding myself having to be like, okay, so how do I shape this function to solve the problem? And so I still, you know, obviously I just didn't do it long enough to become good at it. It's an obvious neural pathway I do not flex. Therefore, it is weak.
Right.
It is very, very weak.
No, that's a really cool concept. And I just want to go try it out now.
Rust is a good middle ground. Have you programmed any Rust?
I've not done Rust yet. I've been meaning to for a long time.
It's a good middle ground because you get iterators and options and results. So you get the sum types and all the fancy terms that functional programmers use.
Yep.
But you can also just do a for loop. And so it's like you kind of get, you know, it allows imperative programming to just exist. And so it feels very nice. And so because, I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, procedural/imperative programming is just the easiest, I think, for all humans to understand.
Yeah.
Because you just read from top to bottom and it just goes like this. Functional is very, you know, swirly. It looks like the Emacs learning curve, right? It's very, you got to like, you know, you're looping on yourself a bunch, which I think just makes it different. But people swear by it, which makes me still so curious. I feel like I need to do more of it because how can people be that excited? It confuses me, right? There has to be something there I'm missing because I haven't used it long enough to become actually good at it.
To be fair, people were very excited about object-oriented programming when they first started doing that. So,
okay, fair. That's fair. This is fair. I mean, I was a part of the clean code. You know, I was all in it there for a while.
My entire start of programming was Java and then Python doing... Actually, don't... Please, for the love of God, don't ever write OOP in Python. It's the most disgusting. Use any other language. It is the worst syntax for OOP you will ever see.
I did use a lot of it, and it's slow. It's crazy slow. It's not just like, oh, it's like 10% slower. No, it's like an order of magnitude slower than just writing dictionaries or whatever and using functions. It's incredible how slow it is.
Yeah,
I didn't know that. I built a parser in it, and it was taking like 10 minutes. I'm like, what the hell is going on here? Threw in a couple functions, and it took like a second. I was like, dude, this is a racket. Like, this is wild. What is happening here?
Just don't do that. So you mentioned Emacs there, and obviously I can't have you on the show without talking about Vim. So
yeah.
When did you start using Vim? And when you first used it, did you actually find it interesting? Or was it one of those things where you're like, oh, this is a cool concept, and just like throw it away for a bit?
So before I can tell you that, I first have to tell you that when I was younger, during the old days of TCP connections between computers and playing some Battle.net, Battle.net Warcraft 2 came out. And on it, there was a ladder system.
Okay,
and cool. I learned I really like trying to compete in this kind of stuff. I really like RTSs. And so I got really into it. You know, I was really trying to become good at doing all the things. A big fan of grunts and the Horde. And I was like, zork, zork. You know, I was like just into it, right? And then Warcraft 3 came out. I loved it. World of Warcraft came out. I didn't like it as much because I was kind of coming into a really like Warcraft mentality.
Right.
And so when I started programming, it was NetBeans. And I tell you what, if you could see those days, I was so fast switching between control, shift, and the arrows. And I would just rage it as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. It was just so good. I guarantee you that if I could just practice a little bit, I bet you I could get good at it again.
Wait, NetBeans is still around?
Genuinely, just like the control, arrows, and shifting and all that, I thought I was genuinely great at that. Mm-hmm. And someone was just like, all right, you got to try Vim. And now when I went to college, I literally thought Vim, that's for old people. That's like stupid, right? It's just stupid. It's a stupid program for stupid old people that want to work on a terminal. Who wants to work on a terminal? Come on, get with the modern times, right? Mm-hmm. Like you know, it takes time to change,
sure,
right?
Sure, no, I know.
So then in 2011, something like that, I had a friend, Bavard Tiberi. He was just like, hey, I'm going to learn Vim motions. Mm-hmm. I need someone to join me because or else I'm going to just lose it if I don't. So can you just join me? Mm-hmm. And I was just like, okay, well, I'm very fast. Maybe I could like Vim motions. And so like day one, I'm WWWBBB. You know, I learned the basic things. I'm in IntelliJ. So I'm using IntelliJ with Vim motion. So I'm just like doing it. And then I discover FNT. And I was just like, oh boy, this is awesome. And then I discover percent sign. So I to delete a function, I'd hit shift V, F, opening squirrely, percent sign, D. Bam, 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 bam. It just felt so good. I was just like, oh my goodness, this is like my previous version of programming, except for I just have more than arrow keys. I have like a whole I have a whole set to describe how I can move really, really fast. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of like when I fell in love with Vim Motion. So Vim Motions have always been the best. Mm-hmm. I don't really mind other editors. It's just editors are just so slow and it bothers me. Mm-hmm. That's it. And so I just use NeoVim because it's just fast. Like I quit using Doom Max because I just kept pissing me off because it would just like be too slow. So I was just like, just move faster, right? And so I quit Emacs, that whole thing, mm-hmm. and did IntelliJ for a long time, but it eventually made me kind of bonkers. But IntelliJ was really good during the JavaScript days before TypeScript. Mm-hmm. IntelliJ was truly the way to do web programming at that point. And so finally, then I tried VS Code for a long time, really didn't like it. And I had a coworker that was just like, just use Vim. Trust, I'll help you. I'll get you set up. And that's when I learned a little bit more about the VimRC, using Vundle to install plugins, all that kind of stuff.
Oh, so you hadn't done any of the plugin stuff before that point?
No, I haven't. So now we're like 2018, 2017, something like that. I had a coworker, Anders Backen. And I went and asked him a question about some older version of the television platform, mm-hmm. and he used Emacs, and he doesn't even type properly. He types like a weirdo, and he just flew so fast, switching, going to old versions, hitting a build, opening up here, fuzzy file, and I'm just like, okay, I'm going to get better. And so like that was really where the fire happened. And so about 2 years after that, then I started streaming and all that, and that's when I learned even more. And then about 4 years after that, I started building a bunch of plugins and kind of really getting into the whole NeoVim thing. Because I just knew I'd never learn VimScript. Mm-hmm. I'm just not going to learn it. It's just too crazy of a language. And it just didn't interest me. It just, mm-hmm. I don't want something that's super bespoke. But Lua is super cool. Lua is great. You can use Lua like embedded into whatever program you're using and be like, I now have scripting powers in my program. This mm-hmm. is fantastic. So I am a huge fan of Lua. And so I have enjoyed learning it and using it for NeoVim.
My NeoVim config is the most cobbled together disaster you will ever see. It's pulled over from my old Vim install, and then I've never like refreshed it, so it's all like it's just been adding on to it over the years, and it works.
You just have a bunch of raw dogged Vim commands.
Yeah,
like with vim.command passing the string, and it's actually just Vim script executing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's beautiful.
Back when people were like really excited about Lua in NeoVim, people were like, oh, you should do some Lua stuff. Because back then I was still really big on doing Vim stuff, really big on doing programming stuff. And now I've sort of shifted away to doing more like general Linuxy stuff. I just never got around to it. Like I really should, though. Like, Lua seems like a neat language.
Great. It's like Go. It's super stupid. Mm. And by being super stupid, you just don't express yourself as much. Right. And if you don't express yourself as much, you end up building simple programs that just do the thing well. Like, that's kind of how this is kind of like my ultimate kind of renaissance of simplicity. It's just like the less ways you can express yourself, the more likely you're just going to write something that does one thing well.
Mm.
And so Lua is a very constrained, simple language. You can learn it in an afternoon. It's not hard. Like, there's some dumb things about it. Like, not equals is not a bang equal. It's a tilde equal. Okay, like, sure. Whatever, right? Like, sure, that's not the end of the world, right? And so there's a couple gotchas. I don't know. I love it. My NeoVim config is the best it's ever been. I'm going to upload it into my own little repository coming up, but it is the best it's ever been. It's mm-hmm. smooth. It's great. LazyVim, a plugin manager, is really, really good. It does a lot of things that I want things to do. Everything just feels good. I'm happy with where I'm at.
So if somebody wanted to get started with... They've not touched Vim at all, and they want to get to the point where they are writing whatever their language of choice is in Vim, what would be the process that you would suggest they take?
Yes, this is a great question. Start with motions, right? Mm-hmm. The hardest thing to do is just to use Vim. You don't know the motions, and now you also are in this program that looks nothing like what you're used to. Have you ever read any C.S. Lewis, the Out of the Silent Planet?
No.
Okay, super great sci-fi book, and effectively, Ransum, the main character, gets abducted and he has to go to Mars. And when he lands on Mars, he looks out and he describes something which is like super, super clever observation of humankind. Where have you ever seen something you've never seen before? And it's like you can't even see it. It's like right in front of you, but you can't see it. And so he describes his experience where there's mountains, there's trees, and there's lakes. And I couldn't see any of it. It was so different than what I was used to looking at. I just couldn't see the landscape. It was in front of me. There was colors, but I was blind to the whole thing. So using Vim for the first time, you kind of get that experience. You don't have a file tree that's ever present. You don't have the tools running along the top. You don't have some other kind of command window right here. You don't have the terminal running across the bottom, right? You don't have this extremely familiar setup. You look at it and you just feel like you can't see the code that's directly in front of you. I even remember my first time using Vim. It was hard for me to program, despite being a good programmer, because I felt like I couldn't understand the code in front of me because it just was such a different experience. And so I feel like that analogy just really kind of drives it home. And so I suggest using motions first, understand how to move in Vim. Then if you really want to make the jump, use Kickstarter. NeoVim, which is like a script, and it walks through exactly how to program a config. Very, very easy. I can get the exact link for it. Very, very simple. Walks through everything. I think TJ has helped out on a lot of it. There's a couple pretty cool people from the community that have worked out and done some good stuff on it. They don't have Harpoon, hurts my feelings, but they do have Telescope. And it'll set you up with a pretty decent NeoVim experience all the way up to the LSP, and you'll have a nice, nice time. And it will not feel as confusing because you at least know how to move. Then it's just trying to get your mind used to not seeing a file tree. So then you're like, oh, well, I know enough about Vim now that I've read Kickstarter. I'm just going to open up a file tree and just set it here and just put it there. Just for the sake of you've always had a file tree there, just put a file tree there so you feel comfortable for a little bit. And then slowly remove things and kind of get off the training wheels. I'm a big fan of only ever having one buffer open. I'm not a big fan of splits. Like, just learn how to navigate your files really, really quickly, and then you don't need it as much. TJ would completely disagree with that. So, fun times.
Yeah, one of the things I found when I first started learning Vim was getting it to a baseline point. And something like Kickstart, I think, would have helped me a lot back then.
Yeah, it's really nice. Like, when you look through it, it's like 200 lines of documentation, like 150 lines of Lua. Mm-hmm. It's extremely simple.
Because one of the things that is really unapproachable with Vim is the first time you open up those Vim docs and you're like, okay, everything's really well documented. It's just, it's that book problem where if you start reading about a language first, you're like, I cannot retain any of this knowledge.
Yeah. Exactly. And so that's why I think going the learn the motions first, feel really comfortable with it, wait till they're second nature, and then maybe consider the jump into actual Vim.
Yeah, while I use Vim, I wouldn't say I use Vim well. I am very heavy on the HJKNL move you around. I know I know a couple of motions to do a couple of things, you know, get to the start of the line, get to the end of a line, things like that. Jumping to specific line numbers, but I have seen some of those shorts you put out, and it's just like you just 20 key presses, you're like, oh, just do this, and it does like all of this magical stuff. Like, what did you just do? What?
So a good thing to do is just adopt one motion.
Right.
Like, that's it. Don't do anything else. Don't try to get a whole bunch in. Just try something. Like, so if you don't use F&T, then start using F&T. Very, very fantastic. For those that don't know, that is jumping forward by the character. So if I say F, capital S, it will jump to the first occurrence of capital S on the line I'm currently at. Okay, so you kind of get that one. All right, well, then start navigating with control D and control U. Like, force yourself to use a half-page jumps. You'll get used to it pretty quick. I actually only got used to it because I started using TMUX. And then since that was the way to navigate up, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, this is actually really easy. At first, it's super disorienting, but now it's actually super easy. Okay, awesome. I'm going to start using that. And so now I use that exclusively. Then I actually built a game in NeoVim so I could learn how to relative jump. So 10J, you know, all that, just so I could force myself into the habit. It's a great habit to be in. And once you learn, once you just do it enough, that's why I built the game, so I just do it enough, it's super easy. Then you get really good at it. So I just kind of did one little motion at a time. And so my big new motions right now is just using much more C. C is really fantastic. C does the delete then into insert mode.
Yeah.
And so my favorite command right now is, I'll paste it to you. But when I'm copying from one thing and going to another thing, I love YIW. That will yank the entire contiguous piece of code I'm on up until white spaces on both sides. Then I can go to another place and VIW to highlight another section of code and then paste in my previous one, right? And so, like, have you ever had, like, you have, like, pattern matching. You have almost the exact same sentence you need to do again. So I, like, paste it, change one of them, and then either use dot, and if I can't use dot just to replay it, I'll just, like, yank out the thing I want and then paste it somewhere else, like, IW is so much fun. If you don't use IW, it is just so sweet.
What would you say to people who think that learning all of this is sort of just like a waste of time and is a distraction when you could just be writing code in VS Code, IntelliJ, whatever editor of choice it is? Like, what do you have to say to those people?
Generally, I think it's mostly a lame excuse. And what I mean by a lame excuse is I don't mean it's not lame to say, hey, I really want to focus on code. That's fine. But what I see is it's learning Vim and doing that isn't about wasting your time. It's about you really wanting to learn your tools better, right? If you use Vim, you'll also find that you have to use grep more often or sed, or you'll have to get JQ, or you'll have to do, you know, like, you start learning your entire system. You just learn more about things. And so I think that at the end of the day, due to me using Vim, I have become a significantly better programmer because I'm more significantly aware of my environment. And I don't know if I would have ever been that if I would have stuck to something like IntelliJ, because I would have just used Control Shift F, searched for all the things, learned how to do all the replace, just use the, which is a very convenient set of tools, but those tools just also exist everywhere. I would have opened logs in IntelliJ and searched through logs and do all that. But now that I'm getting pretty good with JQ, I open logs in Vim, highlight all my logs, execute a JQ statement. It will reduce all my logs into now just a couple keys and all that. And I can go, okay, I like these ones. All right, let's filter again. And like, there's some cool stuff you can do by piping in and out of a file to the command line and back. It's like super neat. And it's just like, I wouldn't have learned all those things if I didn't, you know, do that. And yeah, sure, it was kind of a waste of time configuring an editor, but it also has made me a better engineer. So I'm happy.
That makes sense. No, that definitely does make sense. You mentioned your Linux box before. How long have you been messing around with Linux for? And did that come like from like needing it for work and then doing that, or was Linux an interest? Was Linux an interest before that?
This is gonna sound so stupid. I use Linux for the window manager.
I use Linux with Window Manager as well. Yeah,
That's it. I have no. I don't really want. Like, I've never distro hopped. I used Ubuntu, and now I use Pop OS. Like, I don't have a strong desire to deeply learn Linux, though I know enough about it to kind of, like, if I need to find anything, like, I've learned enough to be able to do stuff. Like, if I oopsie-daisy some stuff, I can go find where things are and delete them out. I generally understand how things are sourced, path, all that kind of stuff, right? Like, I generally kind of understand Linux, but I don't really care as much as the fact that I just want an environment that I can press one key and go exactly where I want to be, always. And I just want it to work, and I just want it to be fast, and I want it to work. I don't care if audio works all the time, which sometimes it doesn't. It's mostly only doesn't because I have this capture card, and the card really is actually where all my problems are at. It's actually now, it's no longer Linux is my problem. It's now the capture card. So that's cool. But it's still just like, that's why I use Linux, is because I want a really good window manager. When I use Mac, there's not a good window manager. It's just like, there's kind of a window manager.
There
when
are
I use
some,
Windows,
like,
Windows is just awful. I can't use Windows. Like, it just, I have to use Unix. Like, I understand Unix. I just don't understand Windows, and it drives me nuts. So I've just kind of stuck with Linux because it works very well for my job. You either use Mac or Linux at my job. No one really uses Windows. Just not really an option, especially if you work on TV, because TV has a kind of a Unix flavored software emulator of the TV that you have to launch and program against. So it's like, you're either using Linux or you're using Mac. There's no other option. And so I don't want to use a Mac. I don't really care for Mac. Like, having a, you know, a quote unquote nice computer doesn't really bother me. I just want something that works and has a really great window manager. And Linux just totally fulfills that.
That's a very different approach from a lot of the people I have on, because, you know, most of the people in my space are obviously, like, you know, diehard Linux fans. Like, I run Arch Linux, for example. There's a bunch of other people that run, I had a guy on not long ago, ran Gentoo, you know, things like that, like daily driving it sort of stuff. I know other people that daily drive Linux from scratch, things like that. But
that's super impressive, though.
It is, yeah. I have done a Linux from scratch install. It's a waste of time. Other shit like compiling a lot of code and doing nothing but compiling code, just bootstrapping an LFS system takes a long time. Just getting all that basic stuff set up, it's not worth it. But I get it, it's cool, and I did it once. But it seems like the way that you use Linux is more of as, like, a tool. It doesn't really matter, like, what the underlying, it doesn't matter what the underlying distro is. Like, you're here for the window manager, you're here for the Unix tooling. The rest of it,
yeah.
The rest of it is just inconsequential. Like, if your distro was swapped out for something else, the only thing that would change to you is, oh, I need to install a package. My package manager is different.
Yeah, I now have a Pac-Man or whatever. I don't know how to say that one. But yeah, it's like, that's it. And because the biggest thing for me is that, like, the reason why I love Linux is really I want the ability to customize my developer productivity. And so that's why I use Tmux. I'm sure I could use Kitty or WesTerm or Ghosty. I actually am on Ghosty's Discord. I have access to it. That's like my next thing I might explore. But it doesn't buy me anything other than I'm using a more modern one. And so I may not stick with it at all. But I just want to, like, my favorite script I've ever built, I call Tmux Sessionizer. I don't know if you've ever seen it or ever used it. But all it does is I press Control F and you have a set of files that you want, and I find across all those files with the max depth of one, or all those directories, and then I put that into a little FCF thing, and you just select where you want, and then it will create a Tmux session in that location. Here's a really simple example. I'll just show you. I don't know if people can see it,
but
now I'm in a work project. I want to go to Vim APM. I'm now in Vim APM. Fantastic. I want to go to my dot files. I could just, again, just Control F, dot files. And now I'm in my dot files. It's just what it is. And so that's all I want to do. If I want to go back and forth, you know, I can just switch back and forth between. I just want that. That's all I want is that. And then I'll type where I want to go and go. So I just try to optimize my experience to be as fast as possible. And so everything, like, I put my work browser on the same location every single time, GIMP on the same location, Slack on the same location. Everything is just a one key press, all the same location. Just try to build it as, you know, as just low overhead as possible.
That is the complete opposite of my system. It is, as I said, as I mentioned about my Vim before, it is thrown together mess that happens to just work. But I really respect the idea of having, like, a super well put together system that, like, just the only honestly the only things that like are consistent in my case, like, one thing I had to do is get my bookmarks out of my browser, because I swap browsers to like talk about them different times. So I have like a script that loads up my bookmarks, and then it just whatever browser I'm currently on. So I don't need to like migrate things, this giant hassle. And I would like to do that for other things in my system as well. But yeah, it's just something I've not got around
to. It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, so that's kind of like, that's my philosophy, is I try to make my most often performed task in the fewest amount of buttons and always the same. So like, I never once think about where is my browser. It will always and forever be position one. Mm-hmm. And that's that. That's my personal one. My work one forever and always will be position eight. Mm-hmm. Slack will always be position five. GIMP six, you know, terminal three. Mm-hmm. It's power finger right in the center. Just, yeah, you know, like, it will just always be that. And so it's just like, I never think, I don't, you know, because the thing that I hate the most is search fatigue. There is no greater way to give me anxiety than watching someone explode on Mac and see all their applications open to find where they want to go. Like, to me, I'm just sitting there like, oh gosh, what is this? You know, use the command tab, but it's not just like, you're not just swapping back and forth, which is a single click. You actually have to like, oh, go, okay, that one. Oh, go, okay, that one. Oh, go. Like, I freak out, because it's just like, press a button to get there. Why are you doing this to yourself?
For me, the biggest one that I need to deal with is my tabs. Because normally when I'm just doing regular things, I don't have that many tabs open. When I'm doing video research, I can have 20, 30 tabs open. I'll have duplicates of the same tab. Like, where is the thing I'm looking? Like, if I'm like trying to do like some video on something happening on the Linux mailing list, I'll have like 20 different emails open in different tabs. Like, where did the email go? What do I do with this?
And I don't have a good system for that yet. No. I hear people use like this grouping idea. There's like these vertical tabs or this grouping
tree style tabs people like. Yeah.
I haven't tried that yet. Honestly, what I do is every time I go to my personal browser, and let's say I want to go to Twitter right now, I go to my personal browser, hit Command-T or Control-T, and type in Twitter. I just open a new one. And at the end of the day, I have 500 tabs open, close them all, and move on.
Yep.
And just like, I'm just no longer going to look for it. I'm just going to, it's easier for me to type four buttons and open it up, because I just need to go TW, enter.
Yeah,
I don't know. Maybe that's lazy in its own unique way, but it makes it easier for me.
Look, you have the RAM there, so you paid for the RAM. You might as well use it.
Yeah.
So, what window manager do you use?
i3. I'm gonna switch to not i3 here soon. Mm-hmm. Sway at some point, but
okay.
Everyone says Sway is good. I gotta go over to Wayland and all that, and enjoy that. I'll do it soon. I still get screen tearing, so I want to not have screen tearing. Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, oh, you gotta use PCOM. You know, Compton's a problem. I've used PCOM and Compton and set all the settings, and I've done so much of it. Yet here I am. I still have screen tearing. So I'm just like, I accept screen tearing, and I will switch one day if it pisses me off enough. It doesn't. I don't see it.
Do you have a like discrete GPU in that system, or is it just like whatever's on the CPU?
Say that again?
Do you have like an actual GPU in that system, or is it just whatever is on your CPU?
I think I have a GPU. Honestly, I don't even know. It's a Lemur Pro. I think it has an integrated GPU on it.
Okay,
typically try to shoot for integrated GPUs, because anytime I've had an NVIDIA GPU, my battery lasts for approximately 14 seconds.
Right.
When unplugged, it's like, I better run to the next outlet because it's going to die. So integrated GPUs is... You know, I'm not gaming on it. It's purely a work machine. I have a 470 sitting right here, the one I'm streaming on right now or recording this video on. I'm going to use that one.
Sure.
I have two 2070s right here. I'm going to, you know, me and my kids, we all play WoW together or Roblox. So I'm just going to use the big machines for that task.
The only reason I mention it is because NVIDIA drivers on Wayland are a bit iffy.
Isn't NVIDIA always been iffy on Linux? Isn't
that
like the whole joke?
Yeah, Wayland notoriously so. Especially with anything older than like a 20 series card. Intel stuff though is fine. You shouldn't have any issues with that. Especially because you're doing your captures outside of Linux. Honestly, most of my issues are due to just capturing on Linux, and yeah, it's a bit messy right now. Tech is like constantly being changed, new solutions are being developed, there's like this portal thing and just all of this nonsense being done. And right now, we're in the middle of that transition period, so nothing is fully done yet. So gives me a lot of talk about. But
last time I played with NVIDIA was during the Bumblebee days. And I was trying to get Bumblebee to work out. And it was a nightmare because I had a Razer laptop that I put Linux on. And I had a big old beefy graphics card that I could game on. It's just like, you know what? That's when I learned I don't want a graphics card on my laptop. Just give me just an integrated one. That's why I love System 76 with like their Lemur Pros. I'm going to buy another Lemur Pro here shortly just because it's so simple. That's all I want.
Yeah,
and then I also have another workstation that's a Threadripper with also an integrated GPU. It's just like I'm never going to play video games on Linux. It's like making fetch happen. It's just not going to happen. I'm just going to play. I know people keep telling me it's going to happen, and when it does happen, it'll be glorious.
I have a Steam Deck on that shelf back there, and I game on this system, so it can happen.
It can happen. Yeah. I've heard of it. I had a good friend, Beastco, if you know him, he's in the Twitch community a bunch. He got his Fortnite account permanently banned because he was using Wine and some sort of GPU pass-through, and he had like $3,000 worth of Fortnite skins. This was during the heyday of Fortnite, and they would just not give it to him back. And he's just like, I'll never play that game again. Yeah. And I feel so bad because he was like, I'm gaming on Arch Linux and got destroyed.
You do not mess with Epic. Epic will smack you down if you try to get around their systems. Yeah,
it's so funny. So I just keep it simple.
Nah, that's totally understandable. I only game on this system because it's one of these things where if things break, that's a video for me. Like that's what everything comes down to. This is why I run Arch. This is why I'm running like cutting edge weird window managers. Like I'm running Hyperland, which is like a Wayland system, and it's like it only has been good for the past maybe like a year or so, and I run this because if something goes down, if anything breaks, I can talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, but that makes sense. You're optimizing for your use case. Like, I am super good at Vim, and I'm making a plugin called Vim APM to measure how good you are at typing on Vim and using motions. Like, I'm optimizing for my own use case, right? Like, that's all I care about. I think that's glorious that you're doing it, right? You're doing the perfect way to do it, which is, I'm going to live a life, and this is the life I want to talk about, and that's what I want to do. Like, I'm not going to talk about Linux because I don't really know. Like, I'm just not that educated on Linux. Like, it's just not for me, but I'll tell you all about Vim motions and tell you the optimal way to do things, right?
Well, speaking of optimal ways to do things, you have sort of perfected the making videos from your stream sort of content. Like, you don't really do actual videos that much anymore. Like, I know, like, hasn't there been, like, a couple? But
yeah, I just released one a couple days ago. But yeah, I'm shooting for about 10 to 12 a year me videos.
Yeah.
I release about 360 to 400 videos on my other channel a year.
And I don't know how you do that. Like, I can hold a conversation in something like this, but when I want to talk about something, especially if it's not React content. React content, I can obviously, like, you know, you can wing that sort of stuff. But when there's an actual thing that you want to talk about, I have no idea how you manage to, like, actually keep a conversation going and keep it somehow coherent and not repeating the same thing over and over again.
Yeah, it's hard. I have to really think about it. I actually think about that quite a bit, is not repeating myself. It's such a danger when it comes to, like, live speaking. It's very hard not to do it. The React content's kind of cool because it's not like watching a funny video and me laughing or, you know, making an emotion. It's more like, let's read this technical blog and let's discuss why I think this is good or bad. And that's like a fun way to do it, I feel like, because the technical blogs are usually really happy that I do it because it highlights some great things. People really like it because most people read like the headline in one paragraph and they don't read anymore. So they just don't even get anything out of like the good stuff. So it's like, I will be the Morgan Freeman narrator for you just without all the good voice. And then we'll just talk about the ideas. I think it's really fun, and it's a great way to kind of go over a concept without having to do just a ridiculous amount of preparation. Because when I make a main channel video, you know, I'm spending 20 hours on a script alone trying to really come up with the idea. So you know how it goes. Like, produce content's very hard.
Yeah. No, I get it.
And I can hold a conversation with myself for hours, so.
Yeah, and then someone in chat.
You know, it also helps that I did streaming for 5 years before I ever even started trying to do any of this. It's hard for me to call it React because it's not quite what modern mainstream would call React in the sense that I'm not watching a cat run into a wall. But nonetheless, it is most certainly React. So it's been super fun. It's like it's been one of the funnest things ever. I'll be doing my first year of doing it will be February 1st.
Wow. Yeah, the style that you do is, you know, there's a lot of, we can mention any number of Twitch channels where it's just like, turn a video on, just like get some food, like just like nothing is being said. It's just like using the content as their content, basically. And then there's channels like Asmongold, where he'll take a 5-minute video and somehow turn it into like an hour discussion. And that's sort of what you do in like
Of my inspiration. Was for it is that after I started doing it, I started like looking up people and I just saw so much crap and I was like, I know there's something good out there. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of started watching some Asmongold stuff and I was like, okay, he's doing it exactly the way I want to do it, which is like use it as a platform and then go off the rails and just talk about the free flow and like challenge chat when chat's like L take, you bring them up on the big board and be like, all right, why?
Yeah.
And you make them be a part of the conversation too. And so it just makes everybody more engaged and want to be a part of the situation, which I think is just a lot of fun.
I know you've reached out to me with like the video that you're going to watch of mine, but is that something you normally do with your content or is that like,
I try to on the videos. I try to on none of the written stuff I do. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine most blogs are unhappy about that.
Sure.
But a lot of the videos I'll try to reach out to just because I don't want to. Some people are sensitive.
Sure.
I had one person give me a pretty good insulting for watching their content. I mean, after I did that, I gave many compliments and their channel grew by like 50%. Like they went from 20s of thousands to like 30s of thousands for subscribers and got a lot more views and things were great, but they still just were so mad at me for looking at their content. So I was like, okay, I'm going to try to reach out first for anyone I don't know just because I don't know.
Sure. I can understand like why people get weird about it, especially when it's a new video, because some people feel like you watching it might be like stepping over the views they would naturally get and it might make the video get less views, but I don't know how anyone really says that after they see the impact that it has on their channel. The only case where I could see it being a negative is if you or someone else was to like completely trash the video and then maybe I could see it, but
Try never to trash a video. Like I'll say, ooh, I don't like that point, or I don't ever try to insult the person because I know that in a sense I hold a lot of their like quote unquote future in my hands by doing this. Mm-hmm. And like that'd just be so rude of me. Like if someone did that to me, I'd be very sad. Even if they're smaller or bigger than me, say something mean about me, I wouldn't like that. And my wife has been really a big kind of driving force in my life saying like, hey, you got to really be careful about how you say things and all that. Mm-hmm. And so I really do try to like lift up the person and really grab out the things I really like. Mm-hmm. I know there was a video not too long ago that like I disliked probably 80% of it. And so I just focused, you know, at the end, really talk about that 20% and why I think that was a really well done part of it and all that. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It can be tricky. It can be tricky because you don't want to ever, you don't want to like destroy someone. That'd be awful. And so it's like, how do you bring up somebody even if you aren't necessarily loving what you're watching?
I think the only exception to that is when someone is trying to be actively malicious. Like, I've had people where they're just blatantly, like, they'll react to my video. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to react to your react. And it's like, they are blatantly lying about what I've said or trying to frame it in a way where this is, you know what they're doing. Like, they are not being, this is not
it's disingenuous
a genuine
stuff.
Yeah. No,
that stuff, you got to handle differently. That one, I still don't know how exactly to handle that one yet. Just because, you know, like when I tweet something, it could get 1,000 or 2,000 likes or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so when I tweet back at somebody for saying something mean or something like that, I don't really want a bunch of people dogpiling in. And so there was a recent adventure I had with somebody who said mean things about me in a GitHub thing. And so I reached out to him privately and said, yo, let's like, you should reach out to me first, man. And he was just like, oh, okay. Yeah. You know, hey, sorry about that and all that. And then like a week later called me a racist. And so I was just like, yo, dog, like, why didn't you reach out to me first again? I feel like we could have had this conversation. It's a little bizarre that you did that. And so he called a whole bunch of people that. Anyways, so it's just like that. It's hard to handle well because it's like, how do I respond to this person? Mm-hmm. And is it even good to respond to the person publicly?
Mm.
I don't know. I'm still pretty out on that one because, again, I, you know, like there's this thing that I have where, you know, people talk a lot these days about like punching down versus punching up. And my general take is if you think that punch is bad one direction, it might be bad both directions.
Mm-hmm.
And so like if I feel it's unfair to do it this way, but then someone hurts me, I really try to think about, is this punch justified or am I really,
sure,
you know, effectively in some sense punching for vengeance and not for justice?
Right. If somebody like, got like 100 views, for example, it's like, do I really need to talk about this? Like, this is stupid, but like, no one really cares.
It's not going to affect me. Yeah.
I get it though. Like
it's hard not to.
I get it. Like I get enough at my size, but I can only imagine at your size, it's a lot more people. There's obviously a lot more people being positive as well, but
yeah,
there's just as much more negative stuff. And it's hard to really work out how to handle that and like what you should do. And it's a learning process. Like most people just don't know how to deal with that much attention. And you have to go through these things. You make mistakes and eventually you're like, okay, well maybe this is a better way to handle this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard.
Yeah.
You
know? We're just past the hour mark now. I'm not sure if you're still good to talk or if you need to like wrap it up.
I gotta bounce because I gotta do a quick workout and then I gotta go take kids to soccer and all that kind of stuff. So
okay, all good. Well, let the people know where they can find you and if they want to catch your live stuff or whatever.
Yeah, Twitter, Twitch, YouTube, all the same name, the Primogen. Yeah, you can go catch me on any of those, none of those. You can insult me, say something nice. I don't know. You make a choice. I mean, me personally, my favorite thing to do is live stream. I like doing stuff live. Like, that's just where I get all my enjoyment from. So,
I'm more of like a clip guy, so I have watched plenty of your individual topic cutouts. But like streaming, I just can't get into. Like, it's like, you know, hours of content, and you like get into them when you join it. You're in the middle of a topic unless you watch from the start of the stream and just. I like the idea of being able to just watch what I want to watch when I want to watch it. So I appreciate the fact that you put out the clips, and I like that most people do this now because it's just, I feel it's a better way to consume the content.
Most of live streaming is empty space.
Yeah.
It's just a fact of life.
Yeah. Especially those ones where they're just eating food and reacting to content.
then it's literal empty space.
As for me, my main channel is Brody Robinson. I do Linux videos there 6 days a week. I've got the gaming channel at Brody on Games. I don't know what's going to be live there. Something, probably The World Ends With You and something else. Check it out. If you're listening to the audio version of this, you can find the video version on YouTube at Tech Over Tea. If you're watching the video, you can find the audio pretty much any podcast platform. Search Tech Over Tea and you will find it. Give me the final word. What do you want to say? Give us your normal outro.
Use NeoVim. Use NeoVim, kids.
Yep, that works. You know, actually, no. You know what? Give us your normal outro. Let's see it. Let's see you come up with one on the spot.
Well, my normal outro would be something like, and the name is. This has been actually a very fantastic podcast, and I'm very, very happy. I can't believe that you actually use Arch all the time. I always think that might not exist, and people just say that on the internet. But you literally are recording a podcast on it right now, again.
Perfect.
How was that?
See you guys later.